This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, the Supreme Court permits Christian prayers before government meetings. Also, Republicans nominate a very electable, very conservative Senate candidate in North Carolina. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, recorded live in Montreal, what happens when Celine Dion is your measuring stick for musical taste? Then, can the inner life of writer Alison Munro's characters travel from print onto the screen? And then, Tatiana Maslany plays one woman with nine freaky lives in the Canadian sci-fi series Orphan Black.
How did you find me?
German had your address. Please, just tell me, who are we to each other?
We'll start with the Political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Supreme Court this week ruled that it's perfectly okay to have sectarian prayers before government meetings. Is the town of Greece ruling a triumph for the free exercise of religion or a backdoor way for a Christian majority to force its beliefs on others? Then, Tom Tillis easily won the GOP nomination for Senate in North Carolina and will challenge Democrat Kay Hagan in November. Has the GOP shaken off its habit of nominating unelectable troublemakers? I'm joined in Washington today by John Dickerson, Slate's chief political correspondent. Hi, John.
Hello, David.
And also in Washington today is Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
Give us this day our daily podcast. This week, the Supreme Court ruled that it is totally fine to have enthusiastic sectarian prayer before a town meeting. The town of Greece, New York, has a tradition, a sort of not very long-lived tradition, of prayer before city council meetings. For more than a decade, only Christian pastors were invited to lead those prayers, which were often overtly and enthusiastically Christian. A Supreme Court majority of 5-4 said, that's basically fine. Why did they do that, Emily?
Well, they have really shifted the ground here and moved from what used to be the test for whether governments can have religious expression. It used to be that if the government was excessively entangled up in religion with what it was doing, that was not okay. Or if the government was endorsing a particular religion, also not okay. But that is the old test designed by Sandra Day O'Connor, who, of course, doesn't matter anymore. And Justice Kennedy finally got to impose his test, which he's been rooting for years, which has to do with coercion. And so what he was saying was that there was no coercion here because the people who were attending these meetings at the town of Greece could have gotten up and walked out or chosen not to pray at these legislative sessions. So it's not that the result is surprising, because 30 years ago, the Supreme Court had said that legislative prayer was constitutional in a case about the legislature in Nebraska. But the way the justices got here is actually huge, in this way that I didn't anticipate, although reading Kennedy's opinion, I should have. And it really opens the door to much more expression of religious faith and really of Christian faith in government settings.
Where will that faith be expressed now? What's going through that door?
Well, Justice Kagan had a bunch of ideas about that. She was talking about the DMV or an immigration naturalization ceremony or a polling place. And there's nothing explicitly that limits Kennedy's opinion, although there's a concurrence by Justice Alito where he says that Kagan is going overboard. And that is actually kind of hopeful, because then maybe he thinks those settings are different and would be coercive. The one thing Kennedy did make sure to say was that he was not changing the test for school prayer, and that the case that says you can't at a high school graduation have a religious invocation, that case still stands. But I have to say, reading the logic of this case, it is almost all the way to school prayer. And the court could take a case for next year that's about whether you could have a high school graduation ceremony in a church with lots of crosses everywhere. And reading this case, I feel like the answer is going to be yes.
And the reason that at a high school presumably would be kept is what? That you can't leave a high school graduation. If you're part of the high school class, you don't have the freedom to leave.
Yeah, exactly. That students would feel coerced by having to listen to a prayer in a way that adults sitting in a town meeting don't. I think this definition of coercion is completely unrealistic and incredibly blind to what it feels like to be a religious minority sitting in a particular setting. And Justice Kagan in dissent did a wonderful job of really expressing that problem, but it just did not move five of the justices.
One thing I wanted to ask you about Kagan in terms of the question of convincing the other justices. Was there ever a route to convince Kennedy or any of the other justices where she could have, you know, because she made the case, for example, that the founders, you know, were not as religious as the majority said. It seems to me you're never going to win that argument.
Like, oh, you would think that could be a winning argument with Scalia and Thomas because they are the chief originalists and they.
But their vision of the originalism is
yes,
not
right.
The
but
actual
she's
historical
right
vision of
about the historical religionism about religion. Now, it's also true that when you look at the 19th century, that the conception of religion in American government and society changes, and that's much. But when you go back to the founding, which is what you're supposed to do if you're Clarence and Scalia, that history's on her side.
Well, I guess my point on that is you can cherry pick that history. I mean, you can pick to make the case that they were fully religious and to make the case that they're not. I guess my point is you have your facts, they have their facts. In terms mm-hmm. of actually making a tactical argument that's going to get them, because that's what this is about, right?
Right?
Is using their own set of thinking to drive them to a result that you want. Was that what she did? Was there a route? Or did she just make some arguments that seem reasonable, but never would to the constituency she was arguing against, which is essentially six people?
Well, I think that since it's really only Kennedy, maybe.
Yeah, I was going to say one person.
He is very wedded to coercion. And then the argument would be, but this is coercion. And there, I actually think what's kind of incredible is that the facts of this case didn't move him. Because what was happening here? For years, the town of Greece had a book of ministers and religious denominations in it. And they would just like call and see who felt like coming. Well, it just so happened everyone in the book was Christian. And they didn't think about the fact that there were some, not many, but some Jews and non-Jew, you know, Muslims, Hindus who lived in the community. And there were synagogues and other houses of worship in the region who they could have included. None of that happened until this suit was filed, in which case there was like a tiny flurry of a rabbi and a Wiccan and a Baha'i guy showing up. And then it went away again. And it was
sounds
all
like
Christian
the
again.
The beginning
like
of a great
crazy
joke. A rabbi,
it
a
would
Wiccan
be a great joke. Here's a question, though. What is the right of non-religious people? Would it be right for the non-religious to say, how about having a non-religious invocation of, you know, something?
It should be. So I actually feel like one of the amazing things about this case is we've moved so far from considering the views of the atheists. So the last time or a last time there was a big Supreme Court kerfuffle about religion, remember the Pledge of Allegiance. Why do we say God in the Pledge of Allegiance? We are so far away from that now. God is like, oh, of course, he gets grandfathered in. The question is, like, how many times can you invoke Jesus over the years and no one else's God without crossing the line into sectarianism? And if you don't think endorsement is the test, then it doesn't matter that the town of Greece completely endorsed
Christianity. Can I make a few random points? One is that I actually think this is a defeat for liberals that is a victory. The actual gain that the pro-religious forces are getting out of this is minimal. So, you know, some town meetings, people are going to feel uncomfortable. If you're a Jew or a Muslim living in a small town somewhere, it won't be pleasant. But that really the kind of aesthetics and the optics of this are very bad for conservatives. And it does feel like this is a way in which conservatives are trying to shove a particular majoritarian vision down the throats of everyone else. And that's not going to benefit them in the long run. That's point number one. Point number two, doesn't this really also point to the divide in America between towns and cities? This would never, ever, ever happen in a city.
Because there would be people of other faiths.
People of other faiths. No, even in a southern city. Even if you're in Dallas or something, this would never happen. Like the places where there's heterodoxy.
Well, you wouldn't have a book where every place of worship in the whole city was just Christians.
Right, and where it didn't occur to people, like, oh, maybe this is a mistake. Where it clearly didn't occur to people in this place that.
Right, right. It doesn't seem like they were deliberately trying to make anyone feel excluded to give them that. Yeah, that's a really good point. I think your first argument is a really interesting one. I'm very divided on how I feel about this. I mean, on the one hand, I think it's such a complete misunderstanding of separation of church and state in America and why we have that. And that's one of the things that's actually really special about the United States and our history. On the other hand, there's a lot of evidence that the European approach, which is completely to have a recognized government religion, is actually better for keeping the peace and that people just kind of move on. They don't spend a lot of time fighting about the role of religion in society.
Do you think, as our resident political commentator, do you think there's any political hay that anyone makes out of the decision, that anyone gets anything out of it politically?
No. I mean, for this to become a national conversation, it would have to show up in the next Republican primaries. There will be a role for, if Mike Huckabee decides to run or Rick Santorum decides to run, they will make their argument. They will be the social values candidate. But, I mean, what are they going to do? Argue about prayer in school? I mean, there's not like a drum they can beat. So this wouldn't be it either, because they won.
Coming up, what on earth is happening in North Carolina politics? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. North Carolina Republicans elected Tom Tillis on Tuesday to run as their nominee against Kay Hagan for Senate. Hagan, a moderate Democrat, it seems one of the most vulnerable incumbents in the 2014 cycle, and Tillis had a relatively easy primary victory, which is going to make it very, very hard for Hagan to hold the seat. Tillis beat off a Tea Party challenger and another challenger further to his right. He was the establishment candidate, but that is not to say he was the moderate candidate. As the Speaker of the North Carolina House, he presided over a remarkable swing right in North Carolina politics, big education cuts, tax cuts, regulation rollbacks, very strict voter ID law, end to pre-K, cutting back on benefits for disabled students. The state gave up on its federal unemployment benefits. They blocked Medicaid expansion. John, why was this victory important for Republican hopes in November?
Well, it was.
Or maybe it wasn't.
Well, no. It's good for Republicans and their hopes in November in one sense, which is that Democrats 6 months ago, when you talked to the Democrats running the Senate campaigns, they were looking to primaries in states like Georgia, Kentucky, and North Carolina for big, messy food fights between the quote-unquote establishment wing and the Tea Party wing, in the hopes that in those fights, two things would happen. Embarrassing things would happen that they would be able to use to brand the Republican Party. And whoever the winning candidate came to be would do some huge backbend to win over the Tea Party voters that they would then be tarnished and both lose the specific race they're running in, but then also do something that could be used to beat up the entire party. That didn't really happen in this race. Tom Tillis, there's a video Democrats are trying to make a lot of, saying it's his sort of 47% moment, 47% referring to a video in which Mitt Romney talked about the takers in America. But it still really kind of hasn't happened, and that's for two reasons. One, Tom Tillis may have been the establishment candidate to the extent that he was backed by the Chamber of Commerce and American Crossroads and people who are promoting the idea of having better candidates run for Republican seats so that these kind of crazy candidates don't run and then lose in places where they should win. But he's a pretty conservative guy. 59% of the Tea Party members said they'd be just perfectly happy with Tom Tillis. So it's not like he's Arlen Specter. And Dave Weigel wrote very smartly about this, which is that basically it's a classification issue here. The differences were at the margin. Brent Bozell, who's a longtime conservative agitator, head of the Media Research Center, said we didn't even play in this race because all the candidates were perfectly fine. When you've got somebody who is in the business of trying to raise money by pointing out distinctions and people who lack purity, not taking a side, you've got a race that's pretty far over to the right. So having said that, then there were all these outside forces that said, okay, there is not going to be a civil war in this race, but we're going to spend a boatload of money on Tillis to make sure that even though there's no real distinction, that in the cut and thrust of a campaign, even the tiniest distinction doesn't blow up into something the other side can exploit. 90% of the money spent in North Carolina, more than any other state, came from outside of the state. And that's in part because of this recognition by the kind of elites in the party that they want to make sure they don't have one of these internal cannibalistic fights that loses them a seat and that gives the other side fodder.
So do you think their intervention, all the hundreds of thousands of dollars they spent,
millions,
even better.
You're living in the
80s. Yeah. Sorry. Yes, I wish I was. Do you think all of that money was about this race, or was it also about trying to shut this down in other races too?
Yeah, I think it's both. I think generally there is a movement among a variety of groups, the Chamber, something called the Main Street Partnership. I was talking to somebody involved in this event, and they were talking about the North Carolina race, but spoke in those general terms, and they said, you've got to squash them like bugs, or else they'll keep coming back. This person didn't mean North Carolina. He meant all races, all of these situations in which it's not the Tea Party. There's an interesting split happening here, which is it's not that necessarily the Tea Party voter is being disparaged by the elites or the Main Street group. It's what they call the purity for profit groups. The Washington groups.
Oh, I love that. I haven't heard that.
Well, that's a term from Steve LaTourette, the former congressman who's at the Main Street Partnership. And what he talks about is basically the Heritage Action Fund, Club for Growth, these groups that basically target members who are not 100% pure and use them to raise money, essentially. John Boehner called out these groups. The argument is basically these groups in Washington that are spending all of your money, not necessarily to win races, are agitating in these races, basically just to feather their own nests. And there's that argument has worked a little bit. I'm not saying it necessarily worked in North Carolina, but it's working more than you obviously would have worked in, say, 2010.
Emily, do you think this means that the Republican Party has successfully figured out how to fold the Tea Party into itself and the Tea Party as a kind of separate, divisive, troublemaking institution within the conservative movement is no longer?
No, because it's just one race, and we have to see whether this attempt at essentially pest control actually works in other places and across the country. And also, the Republicans have to be careful. They don't want to completely fold in the Tea Party because they need its like rabble-rousing grassroots part. Right. They just want to shut down the purity for profit people.
Right. And
about.
Also, if the Tea Party is totally happy with Tom Tillis, it's a victory for
Great.
The Tea Party. So again,
right. I think the Tea Party, this is not a civil war the Republican Party has won. It's a civil war that the Tea Party has won. And
right.
It is now, you know, it's getting its genes are now in the gene pool.
I think that's right. I mean,
Genghis Khan has conquered Iran by filling it with his Mongolians.
And his brother Don. I think there was always a classification failure with the Tea Party, which is that it was called the Tea Party, but they were just movement conservatives. I mean, on the one hand, you had the Tea Party rising, and now the Tea Party genes have been spread, but those genes were always there. I mean, they were always, these are, you know, basically movement conservatives.
Right. The genuinely libertarian part is still
slightly
interesting. Wiggling outside.
Right. I mean,
but they must be small overall. I mean, I love them, but they don't have enough
people. The libertarian?
Yeah, like real hardcore libertarians where the right essentially meets the left.
They don't meet that.
They overlap.
Not when you talk about taxation.
Some issues. No, so, I know, but on some issues they do.
Another primary is the Nebraska primary, in which you have two candidates. One, you know, has been supported by Sarah Palin. The other has been supported by Mike Lee. Again, another situation in which you don't really have establishment versus Tea Party. Shane Osborne, who you may remember from the EP3 plane that went down in 2001, the early part of the Bush administration, it was flying over China. It was a spy plane, got hit. They spent 13 days in captivity. He's running in that race and has been the front runner. But this is another case in which people might say, oh, establishment versus Tea Party, since Sass, the guy who's number two, has been supported by Palin. But in fact, you know, it's not really that. And so it's just more proof of kind of what happened in North Carolina.
I want to make one point about North Carolina, which is the oddness of the state, which is becoming a purpler and purpler state.
And yet,
becoming more and more conservative. There's a fantastic story. I know I talk about the story over and over again on the show by Jane Mayer several years ago about Art Pope, who is a right-wing, wealthy right-wing.
He's the Koch brothers of North Carolina.
He's the Koch brothers of North Carolina. He's associated with Americans for Prosperity, I think. He's got a lot of money. He's got a lot of ideas. And he's now the deputy budget director of North Carolina, effectively the budget director of North Carolina. But he spent a huge amount of money, both directly and then through various foundations and nonprofits that he controls, on turning North Carolina into a red state by funding state legislative elections, by funding very local elections, building up a roster of candidates. And it's paid off. It was a project over a decade or more. And it's been victorious. And they control. They have, veto-proof majority.
Countered the demographic changes in North Carolina prevented the state from going purple when it should be purple.
Right. It's a fascinating story of victory. And again, going back to that great point that Jane Mayer makes, which is that politics is cheap. Like, if you want to buy up a state, if you want to buy influence, it is not that much money, and the payoff can be enormous.
Unless you're Sheldon Adelson, in which case.
Even if you're Sheldon Adelson.
Sheldon Adelson could have spent his money a lot smarter on a state.
Sheldon Adelson has spent several, he spent what?
Right,
maybe $100
million.
I think he's like the most famous billionaire. Everyone listens to him.
Right,
everyone
but his horses keep losing.
The real deals ideas are to be had in the state.
His horses have lost, but it's not, do you see any Republican candidate stepping outside on Israel?
Well, that's not he's not the only one in the conservative movement who supports Israel.
Do you see them stepping outside on gambling issues? Is any of them taking on the gambling issues that he cares a lot about? I don't think so.
Different.
I think he's a very canny, effective. He understands it. It's a brilliant play. I'm surprised there haven't been more people doing it. I think it's easier to do it from the right.
Well, Tom Steyer is doing it on the left right now on environmental issues.
Mm-hmm. I think it is easier. I think it's easier on the right. I do think it's easier on the right. But
why?
Well, because you're trying to persuade politicians to do things in the interests of rich people generally.
Yeah, and so that is more what?
It's easier to persuade Republican politicians to do things that serve the interests of rich people than it is to persuade Democrats to serve the interests of rich people.
But you're assuming that the Democratic gazillionaires who would play this game would be trying to serve the interests of rich people, whereas they may be actually working against their own interests or have other interests, like preventing the disaster of climate change, this Tom Steyer's thing. Depends what your issue is, right?
I guess. I mean, I guess Democrats have, they've been very effective in buying Democrats on financial bank regulatory issues.
Yes, they sure have. The Democrats have been for sale on that. Right. So, in fact, if you pick the right rich person's issue, then you're okay.
Right, but those are right-wing issues.
They
bought
the
Democrats.
Yeah, but they also just prove your point. It's pretty easy to buy Democrats when it comes to the banking.
They're not right-wing issues.
I'm getting confused in my own. I'm lost in my own
good,
argument.
Good, then I somehow won just by confusing you.
All right, we'll leave it there. unless John wants to rescue
me,
as he sometimes does.
I'm just waving from the shore.
You're probably right, but whatever.
I know there's a reason I'm right, but I have to figure it out. I didn't think about it before we started taping. All right. That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts right now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, Orphan Black. It's Canadian, it's television, and it's awesome. And then Hey Chip, Love Ship is an American indie starring Kristen Wiig, but it's based on the short story Hey Chip, Friendship, Courtship, Love Ship, Marriage, which is also Canadian and is also awesome. And finally, we are joined by Slate's music critic Carl Wilson to discuss his recently re-released book essay, Let's Talk About Love, A Journey to the End of Taste. This week, my fellow Culture Gabfest hosts, Julia Turner, Dana Stevens, and I traveled to Montreal, where we taped the Slate Culture Gabfest in front of a live audience at the Blue Met Literary Festival.
All right, I've been appointed the French translator, so I'll just say, je suis Étienne Metcalf, et ceci, c'est le Slate Culture Gab Fest, what is it, en direct de Montréal.
Anyway, welcome. Why don't we dive right in? Orphan Black is a sci-fi and super sexy television series with an implausible twist at its center. It's made in Canada. Additionally, it stars Titania Maslany as a young and saucy no-account who grew up in foster homes and is discovering, much to her dawning horror, that she's only one of several identical clones. Thus, Ms. Maslany's performance iterates out into several identities and accents and personalities and is magnificent. To kick off the show and to score some much-needed money, her character assumes in the pilot episode the identity of the first of her facsimiles whom she encounters. Let's listen to a clip from the show.
I just want some answers.
Are you out of your mind? How dare you show your face in front of my children? How did you find me?
The German had your address.
I've got what you wanted. I've got a briefcase.
Idiot. Do you even know who you're talking to? Where is Beth?
She's dead.
What?
I'm sorry, she killed herself.
No, she wouldn't do that. That's impossible.
No, I'm sorry, I saw her do it.
No, that can't be.
I can explain, okay? My name's Sarah.
I don't care who you are.
Oh, my Lord. Why me? I never wanted any part of this. Do I wear a huge kidney sign on my back?
Please, just tell me, who are we to each other?
Just tell me, Julia, who are we to each other?
All right. So in that clip we just heard, we heard the amazing Tatiana Maslany playing the prime character of the show, a sort of ne'er-do-well called Sarah, surprising one of her clones, a soccer mom called Allison, and talking about the suicide of a third clone, a sort of prim cop called Beth. So I'm sure that was very easy to follow for those of you who hadn't seen the show. But one thing I think you do get a sense of is the amazing virtuosity of this performance, right? So the prime character, Sarah, is, it's somewhat complicatedly set up, is a Cockney-ish accented immigrant from Britain. But the show is set in kind of an anonymous Canada. They're using Canadian currency. It's shot in Toronto. But you get a sense of how precise she is with the different accents just from hearing them, I think. And if you're watching and can see as well, I find the performance to be totally mesmerizing, right? I mean, she's not, it's not, outmoded, outlandish, wild mannerisms that she just seems to inhabit these totally different versions of herself. I found it very easy to forget the stuntiness of the performance. What did you guys think?
Well, what I've seen of it, I love, and I agree I want to stick with it. I see that the criticism of the show could be that although the performance itself is incredibly impressive and not merely a stunt, that it really is built completely around the personality of this woman, Tatiana Maslany, and her ability to shapeshift and morph. And that, to me, some of the, how would you describe it, the deep mythology of the show, I mean, it is one of those shows like The X-Files or like Buffy the Vampire Slayer where there are all kinds of currents. You know, you have to watch many episodes in a row to see these worlds. So if you're somebody who likes shows with deep mythologies like The X-Files and Buffy, you will have the patience to stick with that. But this show does not feel like, how can I express this? It's being made up as it goes along, which in a way suits the policy of the main character, who's sort of this MacGyver, right? Whatever situation she finds herself in, Sarah, we're talking about the principal British incarnation of the clone club, she finds some crazy way out of it with whatever she's got on hand. And so that MacGyver element is part of what makes the show fun. But to me, it also feels like the writers are MacGyvering it a little bit. So I worry what's going to happen in the second season, which just started.
Julia, one of the things I would love to talk about the show is the Canadian-ness of it. Not that I know what exactly that word would signify, but let me get it from a funny angle, which is when you read about other film cultures that as insecure Americans we maybe overesteem a little bit, what they were always responding to in American filmmaking was and in all of American popular art, was its incredible instinct, its reliance, and, you know, as Americans, we might think of over-reliance on pure instinct, the ability to piece together films so that they flowed, they paced. It was something somehow that found its way or was already in the American bloodstream in some respects. When you watch the show, it's wonderful. And one of the things I like about it as a self-loathing American is that it just doesn't quite feel American. It feels as though it is coming from someplace else, though you would be hesitant to be able to put your finger confidently on where that was or what that quality was. Do you agree it has some feel that it just doesn't feel like it was shot in Anaheim or Burbank?
I'm not sure I agree with that much.
Oh.
I mean, I think the show that this reminds me most closely of, I think the Buffy analog is a good one, and I'm a huge fan of Buffy, Dana, so I like that comparison. The show it also reminds me of is Alias, which is the show. How many of you guys saw Alias? You know, which was the J.J. Abrams breakout show that starred Jennifer Garner, well, beyond Felicity, but it was one of his early shows that starred Jennifer Garner in a series of wigs. She was actually one person wearing lots of different wigs and not clones of herself, but the conceit that one talented actress plays many different versions of herself, has to get out of crazy situations while fighting various mysteriously named shadowy forces, it's a very similar structure for the show. Mm. And I actually sort of wish the show played up its Canadian-ness a little bit more. Basically, I think this is a problem in the show generally. There's incredible specificity in Tatiana Maslany's performances. I mean, it really feels like each of these clones is a very grounded, specific, fascinating character. But the world is a little fuzzy. Like, the boyfriend of Beth, the cop, is kind of like a blurry blonde blank. The cop world that she inhabits, sort of cop procedural that the show becomes part of the time when she's pretending to be Beth, this clone that has committed suicide, is a little bit vague. And I think similarly, the Toronto or the quasi-Toronto that the show is set in feels a little bit vague to me.
Mm. And it's hard to know whether that's a deliberate artistic choice or whether it's a kind of an attempt to obscure the Canadian-ness to make it kind of more globally appealing on the market. You have to look hard. Occasionally you'll spot an Ontario license plate driving by, but otherwise there aren't really any geographical markers.
Well, and there's a stack of $75,000 that are red. So that's a real tell.
That in itself is a novelty. Somebody getting a briefcase of money that isn't green. You never see that.
No, I love it. Okay, so for our working definition of Canadian-ness is fuzzy and red money. I like it.
But that brings me to a question, actually, about the vagueness of the other characters, particularly the male characters, and this boyfriend who the main character finds herself suddenly thrown into a relationship with. He's essentially pretending to be someone else, one of her clones, and so she has to get up to speed on what her job used to be, what her relationship used to be. I think that is all a great twist. But I've read in several places, and I wonder what you guys think about this, that this show has a man problem, that essentially it has the reverse of the longstanding problem of females being underwritten and undercharacterized in pop culture, and that all the men are boring, stupid louts. And the question is, I think that's pretty much incontestable, that all the men are boring, stupid louts.
We have a third definition for Canadian.
But so my question to you is, did that bother you? Do you find it to be true or not? Do you think it's deliberate on the part of the show's creators, who are men, both of them, but who have created, I think, a profoundly feminist work?
Well, let me agree with you and also add a little asterisk, which is that the performance of Felix, the foster brother of the main character, I love. I mean, I could see some people might feel the scenery being chewed a little bit.
But I think the idea is that he's a gay character and that all the straight men are the ones that are the boring, stupid louts.
A fourth definition of comedian, or 3B, I would say. No, I haven't picked that up on the show necessarily, but I'm a boring, underwritten stereotype. So I identify with all the men in the show. Now I know why.
I guess the question, I think, is whether it's a conscious choice on the part of the show's creators and sort of part of the feminist underpinnings of the show, or it's part of the kind of MacGyver fly-by-night nature, and the men are just like obstacles that she must vault over, and therefore they don't have full characters. I tend to lean a little bit more towards the former theory. I think the gender politics of this show are fascinating. And I think the fact that the show is kind of fun and a little bit of like a B-movie style show in the spirit of Buffy or in the spirit of Alias. I mean, Buffy and Alias are two shows that had most interesting commentary on gender politics of maybe any two TV shows I've seen in the last 10 to 15 years. I mean, it doesn't, just because the show is goofy doesn't mean it can't have smart things to say about gender. And actually, I think some of the smartest gender commentary in pop culture sometimes does come through goofy venues. So I guess I'm going to wait and see just how blank the men remain forever. But I'm kind of okay with the blank template because I'm assuming it's part of a strategy for now.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like part of the show's language. And so insofar as I'm interested to see how the show establishes that language, I'll stick with it.
Okay, I'm here by going to interject and tell you how much fun you're having in Montreal. We've just spoken for 13 minutes. Didn't it feel like five? That was amazing. The show is Orphan Black. It's if you happen to be in America, it's on something called BBC America. In Canada, it's presumably, you know, falling off of trees like ripe fruit. Check it out. Let us know what you think at www.facebook.com/culturefest.
You're listening to the Slate Culture Gabfest recorded live in Montreal. Coming up, does Hollywood master or mangle Alice Munro's modern fairy tale, Hateship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage? This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. This week's Culture Fest was recorded live at the Blue Met Literary Festival in Montreal. If you'd like to find links for the things that we mention on the program, well, guess what? We collect them for you on our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. And please, if you would, leave a comment while you're there. Tell us what you think of us. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. All right, back to the live show.
All right, moving on. Hateship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage is a short story, a long short story by Alice Munro. In my humble opinion, she deserved the Nobel Prize for this story alone. It has been adapted into an indie movie by director Liza Johnson and the screenwriter Mark Poirier. It stars Kristen Wiig, Guy Pearce, and Nick Nolte. He's so Nick Nolte in this movie. The usual drill is for us to play a clip from a movie such as this one, but we can convey the tone of the film simply by saying, pregnant pause. It is so filled with pregnant pauses, Dana, we couldn't really find a credibly listenable segment from the movie. It sounds like I'm running the movie down. It's really that I love the short story, and we'll get to all of that. I want to ask you, what do you think? Did you like the movie?
Yeah, well, it is a very tall task to adapt Alice Munro. It has been done very well by Sarah Polley in Away From Her, the movie from a few years ago that was an adaptation of another story from this same collection by Munro. I think this is a less successful adaptation, but when you've got a story this good to work with and a character this good and an actress as good as Kristen Wiig is in this part, I think it's still something that's really worth seeing. But there's something about the complexity of that story, particularly in its shifts of points of view, right? You talk about how it starts off with, you know, what the station agent is thinking about the furniture shipping woman. I mean, that kind of perspectival shift is pretty hard to capture on film, and so the movie doesn't really try. It puts the order of events in chronological order, where in the story there are all these sort of mad skips among generations and time frames, and it's sort of orders it, you know, in a more Hollywood-friendly way, I would say. But that said, it really does have something Munrovian about it in its spareness and its use, as you were saying, of silence. You know, it's not a movie that tries to cram every minute with information and event, and I liked that about it.
Julia, there has been a slow, stately unfolding of my love for Alice Munro over the last few years, and it's just growing and growing and growing and deepening and deepening and deepening. Some of the sentences from that story, I just read the story for the first time yesterday. You know, reading them doesn't make them sound fancy because they're not fancy. They're just perfect, especially in the context of the story. I know that the story has recently come to mean something to you. You read it in a book group. Talk a little bit about the story and whether you were pleased to find it up on screen with Nick Nolte.
I'm always pleased to find Nick Nolte on screen. I hadn't read very much Alice Munro until prompted by her winning the Nobel Prize. My book group read this collection of stories, and we all came into book group and were just like, what the hell have we been reading? This woman is so much better than anything else we've read. And we were reading some pretty good books. And so I was amused. I read Laurie Moore reviewed the collection for the New York Review of Books when it initially came out in the early 2000s. And she quoted another writer who said, the stories of Alice Munro make everyone else's look like the work of babies. Which is literally, I mean, I thought it was striking. That
was Ethan Kanan, right? The author Ethan Kanan who said
exactly.
That.
I thought it was striking that it was the exact same response of like she just is operating on such a sophisticated level that you marvel at what she accomplishes, and yet her work is not, it's not showy, it's not flashy, the prose is not look at me prose, it's just incredibly lucid and lucid into what it feels like to be in a character's mind. I mean, just the way she's able to convey interiority in fiction is mind-blowing. Obviously film is in some ways a medium that is very good at interiority, right? It's all about evoking a mood and putting us in the perspective of a character and helping us get a saturated, multi-sensory sense of the world around them and how it affects them, which can evoke a sense of what it would be like to be inside their minds. But it's much less direct, I think, than Alice Munro. I mean, you know, one tactic is voiceover, which thankfully this movie does not employ, right? But we're left to read a lot on Kristen Wiig's face, which... Mm-hmm. I'm curious what you thought of it. I at moments loved her performance and at moments didn't.
I thought she was good in the movie.
Okay, wait. I have one blanket response to the idea that film cannot communicate interiority. I mean, there's no question that there's a different language of communication of interiority, but film has the close-up, right? I mean, film has the human face. It has something that literature doesn't have that, you know, that can go a long way towards...
Le visage humain?
Eh bien oui.
Eh bien oui.
And I think in that sense, Kristen Wiig she's a little bit miscast in this role. If you read the story, Johanna Perry, the character she plays, who's a spinster and a housekeeper and someone who spent her whole life in the shadow of her employers and essentially sort of has no, I don't know what you'd call it, sort of, she has interiority, but she has no sort of self in a way. It's strange to see Kristen Wiig playing that role when we associate her with so many comic characters and, you know, she's got this goofy mobile face. And so there are moments that I sort of felt maybe she shouldn't have been cast. She's also a little too pretty and too young to play this plain middle-aged spinster from the story. But I thought she was really a revelation and fantastic in the role. It made me excited. This, along with another movie she recently made, The Skeleton Twins, coming out later this year with Bill Hader, where he plays a dramatic role as well, made me look forward to a career of Kristen Wiig as a dramatic actress. Mm-hmm.
All right, well, the movie is called Hate Ship, Love Ship. Show of hands, how many people have read the Alice Munro story that it's based on?
Clap. Don't show of hands. Clap.
All right, those of you who haven't, you're in for an absolute treat. It's amazing. All right, moving on. Bring up Mr. Carl Wilson. Hey, welcome.
Welcome.
All right, before we properly introduce Carl and get into the segment, I thought it would be important maybe, Andy, if maybe we could set the mood a little to something maybe a little obscure, maybe très intime, you know, maybe even something placating to Dana and her nerves because she hasn't had her morning eye opener yet, you know, maybe a little Malaysian bird song or something. What do you have?
We don't get more? Andy.
Oh, my God.
You're not letting her belt it out.
Yeah. We have to provide the crescendo ourselves.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Carl Wilson was the pop critic for the Toronto Globe and Mail. He has migrated virtually at least south, and now, lucky us, he is Slate's music critic. His book, Let's Talk About Love, has just been reissued with a new sous-titre. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's wonderful to be here.
Before we get to the question of taste, good taste, bad taste, and Celine Dion, let's start somewhere else. Let's start with the 1997 Academy Awards. Carl, explain to me how it was those Academy Awards planted the seed for this book.
Yeah, well, it was sort of, I lived in Montreal in the 90s, and so Celine was ubiquitous here, as she was everywhere, but particularly here, I think. And so I had a vague awareness, and it was kind of during a phase of my music listening life in which the radio didn't really play any role and TV didn't play any role, and I was pretty wrapped up in my cultish world of indie rock and experimental jazz and things like that. So I had this awareness of Celine as this pop powerhouse. But the Oscars, the year that Titanic came out, became this kind of staging ground for a battle between the forces that I felt Celine represented and my side, because unusually an indie type, Elliot Smith, was nominated the same year for the music from Good Will Hunting. And the staging of it couldn't have been more supportive of my sense of beleagueredness in pop culture, in that Celine, as you may well remember, sort of appeared as if she were on the deck of the Titanic in her performance, and there was a full orchestra, and there was wind blowing and dramatic lighting, and Elliot Smith came out for his segment in sort of an ill-fitting white suit, all by himself with an acoustic guitar, looking like on this vast stage as though he'd maybe gotten lost somewhere on his way to the bathroom, and played beautifully, but there was just this sort of complete contrast of showbiz cultures going on there. And then, of course, inevitably, Celine won the Oscar. And I had that feeling of, like, even when we get close to the, you know, when there's some recognition, of course, logically, the powers of mainstream showbiz win and flatten you. And so I kind of nurtured a little bruised feeling about that night. And when I came around to thinking about writing about Celine, that was one of the first things that came to mind. But the funny thing is that I found out later that Celine and Elliot Smith had an encounter backstage where she dropped by his dressing room and gave him an enormous hug and said, "You must be so nervous. I know you're not used to this kind of thing," and treated him very nicely. And for the rest of his unfortunately short life, whenever people mentioned Celine Dion or him having met her, he would kind of bristle immediately to her defense and talk about what a wonderful woman she was. So, which was one of those nice moments, that very moving to me, really, of those streams kind of crossing and realizing that the humanity of these people actually does defeat what the roles we cast them in symbolically in culture.
You set out to write this book about hating this music, right? About trying to understand your own taste, trying to understand what you personally abhorred and why. And then you are an incredibly sympathetic and subtle critic, so you had to put yourself in all these possible ways of understanding her. But tell our listeners where you came out.
Well, you know, I mean, at this point, you know, with the publication of this new edition, it feels like a rounding of that process, but it also means that I've sort of been living with Celine for 7 years or so. So I find it hard now to even say what my relationship is to her. I felt at the end of the book that what had happened is that I'd certainly come to understand where she stood as a figure in showbiz and what kind of work she was doing, and realizing that that has a kind of enormous history of this kind of big sentimental music made in North American pop, and it often isn't the stuff that gets canonized and enthroned. And at the end, what I felt like was that I came to appreciate a lot of her music, but not all of it. Some of it still seemed kind of not sure-footed to me and a little awkward, but a lot of it is really beautifully produced, and you kind of have to dig into the catalog, and especially the French catalog, actually, like, is a bit of a cut above the English one. So I became sort of a partial fan. But I think that one of the things that's important doing this kind of exercise, you know, one of the cheap answer would be to be, then I came to completely appreciate her and I'm a big fan and all of these things. And I think that that's a little bit, you know, a lot of what the book talks about is how who we are in our identities and how we form ourselves kind of determines in many ways the things that we become a fan of. And it seems to me a little bit like cultural imperialism to believe you can just delve in and then you're just like the people who adopted her more instinctively and that kind of thing. And I think that I can appreciate her while maintaining that distance and being like, yeah, that's not where I come from, you know?
Yeah, I mean, to move beyond Celine, if such a thing is possible, au-delà de Celine. The thing I took away from your book that's really influenced, I think, the way I work as a critic and also just experience culture as a consumer, is this idea of taste as a kind of defense mechanism, a cultural defense mechanism and a psychological defense mechanism, and the way that, and I wrote this down because it was such a good quote, critical authority depends on the power to exclude, you say, right? And you also quote, I think, Paul Valéry saying, every like is made of 1,000 dislikes. And that is just something that comes up so much in every conversation about culture that you have, and once you start to become aware of it in the way that this book made me aware of it, it really does sort of change your identification with what it is you love. I wonder if you could speak to that at all, or if other people have told you that that has stayed with them.
To some degree, yeah. I mean, you've just stated it really well, so in some ways I feel redundant responding. But yeah, that sense of, you know, that we're not aware of when we're sort of, especially in adolescence, I think, forming ourselves culturally, but throughout life, and there's been sociological research backing this up and that kind of thing, that there's a tendency of using cultural objects to define who you want to be and who you don't want to be. And those things have deep class significance, and they change from place to place. So those attachments mean really differently, and over time it changes. You know, when the body of really big sociological work was done on this, that kind of fell into conventional highbrow, lowbrow, middlebrow places, and those things corresponded quite closely to class position. But now there's kind of a new cosmopolitan, you know, brow-mixing culture that is actually a new sort of sign of sophistication. So you need to have a little bit of, you know, maybe it's a little bit of World Wrestling Federation and a little bit of, you know, a little bit of Japanese right. manga and, you know, a bit of Truffaut and a bit of heavy metal or whatever it is that makes you seem like you're really curating your yeah. selfhood.
Right. No, you know, that's right. Yeah, no brow eclecticism is
yeah,
the,
exactly.
the defining.
And so these things change over time, and one of the things that's clever about them is that they keep moving so as not to be recognizable as blatant plays to be admired. Mm-hmm. But in some subconscious level, I think that is what happens. And so what was really valuable about going through this process for me was to challenge those things in myself and to realize that all of these things have a story behind them.
Carl, you in this, you have helped me locate the one flaw in your book, which is that we could talk about it forever. But we only have 10 minutes, and we've exceeded that vastly. Carl Wilson lived with Celine Dion for 8 years and lived to tell about it. A remarkable feat in and of itself. Tell me the title of your book again.
It's Let's Talk About Love.
Of
the
course.
New subtitle is Why Other People Have Such Bad Taste.
Wonderful. People. Sorry, I blanked for a second. People should go buy it. All right, well, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse Dane. What do you have?
Special Canadian version of my name with extra nas. All right, I have to consult my notes for this endorsement because it's got a lot of proper names that are somewhat new to me, but I'm going to endorse a writer, an Angolan writer that I discovered at this festival. He goes by one name, Cher style, and his name is Onjaki. He's a young man from Angola, and he has written a couple of novels. I think he wrote a children's book. He apparently made a documentary about Angola. And apparently, in the last 10 years or so that I haven't been keeping up with Lusophone literature, he's become this phenom in Lusophone, that is Portuguese-speaking world literature. So he has two books. One is called Good Morning, Comrades. The new one is called Grandma 19 and the Soviet Secret. And his name, again, is Onjaki from Angola.
Amazing. I will seek that out. Julia, what do you have?
I also have an endorsement that I discovered here in Montreal, and I'm a little bit tentative about giving it because I think that this endorsement is kind of the equivalent of going to Anaheim and then claiming to have discovered Walt Disney. but I was walking around Montreal and looking in various galleries and shops, and I came across some drawings by a man named Norman McLaren. So Norman McLaren, as far as I've learned from subsequent intensive obsessive Googling over the last 48 hours, is essentially like the grandfather of Canadian animation. He was a Scot originally, but settled here in Canada, and basically did really interesting avant-garde animation work, producing these beautiful short films in the 40s and 50s that looked like stuff you'd find in the 70s almost. I mean, he seemed very far ahead of his time. He also did a series of incredible movies. He won an Oscar for Best Documentary for his piece Neighbors. But you can find a lot of his work on YouTube. I mean, there are these very short, beautiful, experimental films. And one I particularly loved that I was watching on YouTube this weekend is called Horizontal Lines. And it's sort of a mesmerizing symphony of moving lines. It almost looks like they're swimming laps against each other on a sea of colors. And it's just gorgeous. So Norman McLaren.
Julia, that sounds amazing. All right, well, it says in my Word document here, in all caps, it says, this is not a suck-up. But my two favorite political philosophers are Canadians, it turns out. The fact that I notice about them every now and then, and I think it's distinctive of them for the reason that I think you need to be close to the pathologies of the United States, but not of them, in order to properly diagnose the current political situation. By current, I mean broadly construed. They wrote really their best work between 50 and 30 years ago. Anyway, the two are C.B. McPherson and G.A. Cohen. I have endorsed G.A. Cohen in the past. One of the reasons I came to know his work is that he's one of the chief explicators and critics of the American libertarian philosopher Robert Nozick.
McPherson I don't believe I've endorsed before, in part because I just don't want anyone else to get a hold of it, none of my competitors, to have this magic stash of just searingly brilliant insights into political philosophy and social reality. My favorite book of McPherson's is probably his most famous, is The Political Theory of Possessive Individualism from Hobbes to Locke. And for those of you who don't care about these kinds of things, I can hear your brain going to sleep when I read that title. However, what I want to say is that his analysis of Hobbes and Locke are so gripping, they feel he implants a sense of intellectual mystery in your head. So you want that mystery solved so badly that you read these things almost like gripping thrillers, and he gets to the solution. I mean, he really says, how could Locke have believed this? Like, how could anyone believe this? And not only that, I mean, he is literally the thinker whose words flow into the Declaration of Independence, and there's something essentially false about those words or the concepts behind them. There are many ringingly true and beautiful and almost transcendentally beautiful things about them, but there are many false things about them, and we live those falsehoods in the United States. So it was an act of, to my mind, total revelatory genius for someone to have reread Locke with the degree of originality that he did. So that is my endorsement here in Canada.
That sounds awesome.
I think we did a show.
Seems that way.
Dana, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Julia, a total delight. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, TuneIn, or in the WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate GabFest. GabFest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Hepperman and Mike Vuolo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the GabFest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll talk to you next week.
A whole different country, 500 miles from here. Don't go telling everybody, or they'll get the same idea. 500 miles from here, Montreal.